judging by appearances, was rife in Shakespeare's London. In an ironically truthful moment, his Richard III warns us that no more can you distinguish of a man than of his outward show, which, God he knows, seldom or never jumpeth with the heart. What he means is that attempts to uncover a person's true nature based on what they look like are doomed to failure. God knows that the heart and the face rarely match up. But in the 16th to 18th centuries, what historians call the early modern period, people did try to use the appearance of the face and body to make judgments about people they met. We do the same thing today, whether we admit it or not, and we respond to this judgment by altering our appearance, brushing our teeth, cutting and dyeing our hair, washing our faces, combating pimples, wrinkles, and dryness, and going even further with surgical and cosmetic treatments, all so that we can meet expectations about putting our best face forward. Oliver Cromwell may have wanted to be represented warts and all, revolting against the idealised portraiture of leaders before him, but I want to know how facial appearance really affected how people were treated in early modern Britain. Few people could expect to have entirely clear skin, or all of their teeth, and a great number carried scars of injuries or infectious diseases like smallpox, syphilis, and scrofula. So you might expect that people were more accepting of facial variations. Well, yes and no. Substantial facial difference was remarked upon. People used medicines and cosmetics to change or cover their faces, and portrait artists politely overlooked flaws. A key reason for this was that they knew that they would be judged by their appearance. People used a range of systems to quickly assess others and to make sense of the world around them, from religion and astrology to physiognomy and medicine. They could help you know who to trust or who to avoid, and offered reassurance for people worried that things were becoming a bit too complicated. Historians know this because so many people complained that the systems didn't work, that too many people were able to hide who they really were. Moralists worried that new clothes and hairstyles meant you couldn't tell men and women apart, or that the person outwardly demure and praying was actually a heretic or a witch. And as for that beautiful woman, well, definitely a temptress corrupted by vanity. Changing economic circumstances meant that social status based exclusively on birth was, at least in theory, disappearing. People raised themselves through business, and the new middling sorts could buy the types of luxury goods that had previously signalled you were a member of the nobility. Suddenly, anyone could look this good. Fashionable men and women were nothing but piles of cosmetics, wigs, and padding, hiding their natural ugliness and ill health. Flick through the illustrations of 18th century artist William Hogarth, and you'll see people painting their complexions, wearing patches over spots and sores, or larger covers for missing eyes and noses. People bought replacement teeth from the mouths of the poor, whose low-sugar diets kept them in better nick than their aristocratic neighbours. Men could carry off a small battle scar, and plenty of aristocrats emphasised them in their portraits by adding attention-drawing silk patches. But for women, beauty was considered a key asset, and its ruin a tragic blow for her chances at a good marriage. In his 1714 textbook, the surgeon and physician Daniel Turner describes treating a woman who fell into the fire while in a fit, badly burning her face. After treatments, she now covers the worst of her scars with patches and a handkerchief, professes piety and humility for God's action upon her, and offers, he says, agreeable conversation. This unnamed woman gives us a glimpse of how genteel women might manage such accidents and changes to their appearance, making it clear that her beauty is more than skin deep. Her handkerchief and patches are excused by her honesty and good nature, and her resignation that her face is a gift and an instrument of God. But others were not so honest. So, given the chance, you had to try and read the bare faces of people around you. And the early modern Britons had ways to make this easier. The law inflicted cuts and brands so that people carried a visible criminal record for the rest of their lives. People reprieved of the death penalty were branded on the hand so that they could not repeat the escape. This is the medieval benefit of clergy. While others had their ears pinned or cropped, their nostrils slit, or letters branded into the face. people learned the telltale scars of venereal diseases, such as the flattened nose associated with syphilis. Systems of physiognomy blended old folklore and new science. Metaposcopy focused on interpreting the wrinkles on your forehead, as others did with the lines of the palm. According to 16th century Italian polymath Gerolamo Cardano's guidebook, a man with three horizontal lines and a sideways Z between his eyes will die of plague. Meanwhile, a woman with a cross above her eye and a mole under it will have two husbands, sex with churchmen, and die of poisoning. Copies of his book are available online if you'd like to grab a mirror and check your fate. If such information has you reinterpreting the marks on your face, well, this is nothing new. Early modern people had to make sense of their own faces and bodies, as well as of others. And these interpretations often conflicted. We sometimes see this in those marks made by the law. In 1637, the ardent Puritan William Prynne had his ears cut off and his face branded with the letters SL for seditious libeller. But he insisted that the marks on his face now showed the crimes of others and published a pamphlet explaining that the letters actually stood for Stigmata Laudis, which means the stigma of Archbishop William Laud. His associate Henry Burton also lost his ears on Laud's orders for his religious opinions. But Laud and Charles I were replaced by Cromwell's Puritan Parliament in 1649. Suddenly, men like Burton and Prynne were on the right side of religious power, so they were released from prison. Supporters talked reverently about how the elderly and earless Burton's appearance in the pulpit reminded everyone of the hard-handed rule of king and archbishop that they had fought to escape. But what about other types of facial difference? Those warts and wrinkles, lumps and bumps, cleft lips, burns, pox and spots. People whose faces were significantly different or had been changed by accident or illness asked, "Why me?" And the people who saw them asked the same question. There is, in the end, the physical thing itself, the meanings that people in different times and places bring to them, and the ways these meanings affected people's day-to-day lives. The simple fact of a wart on a woman's nose becoming a story she is a witch, becoming people recoiling or even punishing her as one. In early modern Britain, many people assumed that any illness or infirmity was a punishment for sin, turning the resulting swellings and scars into visible evidence. These battles of interpretation could therefore turn facial difference into a disability that affected people's relationships with their communities, their sense of themselves, and their ability to work and support their families. For the contest of naturalist and spiritual ideas around disfigurement, I would like to introduce you to a Royalist Welshman named Arise Evans, who became famous in London for sharing prophecies of the civil wars and advocating for the restoration of the king. Evans was born around 1607 as Rhys Evans, but seized on Arise as an evocative name as he began to embrace the role of visionary. In about 1659, he developed a large swelling in his nose. Commentators described it as fungus, ulcerated and scabbed, a very despicable and blasted face, so that it was not only nauseous to view, but very fetid of smell. But Evans just lamented that it was disfigured, and surgeon John Brown noted that Evans covered his face with a red cloth in public. Now, Evans was convinced that the touch of the monarch could restore his nose. The ceremonial royal touch had allegedly been used since Edward the Confessor to cure a disease now known as scrofula, which is a form of tuberculosis. It became known as the king's evil and is most characterised by ulcerous swellings on the neck. The monarch could cure this ailment by touch because they had been appointed to the throne by God and thus acted as a channel for divine power. The success of these cures strengthened the monarchy's authority, and the Tudors and Stuarts embraced the ceremony wholeheartedly, with Charles II touching an estimated 96,000 people. It helped fulfil the ruler's obligations to care for the common people who maintained them. Picture Elizabeth I, according to her chaplain William Tooker, with her very beautiful hands, radiant as whitewashed snow, courageously free of all squeamishness, touching their abscesses not with her fingertips, but pressing hard and repeatedly, with wholesome results. Now, surgeons did offer other treatments for the King's Evil, but Arise Evans rejected such base medical interpretations of his face. He described it as a sign of God and was convinced that only the holy touch of the rightful monarch would remove it. So, in 1660, Evans sought out the recently restored Charles II while he was walking in St. James's Park. Elias Ashmole described Evans accosting the king with a gruesome face, thus throwing him into the history books as an impolite madman. But we're going to take Evans' own account instead, where he says, "Upon my bare relating of my name, His Majesty called me to him, gave me his hand to kiss, promising to remember me. And having an evil humour that did disfigure my face much, the very touch from his blessed hand, for I did not kiss it because my mouth was sore, wrought such an alteration in my body that on a sudden the humour was gone, and my neighbours knew me not by my face." In his published account of the incident, Evans offers up his ulcerous nose as a literal godsend. Its cure by the king's blessed hand is evidence of the new monarch's divinely ordained place at the head of the kingdom. Evans' story brings us back to the competing interpretations of faces and their marks, and how these could affect how people thought about themselves and others, and how they acted toward them. People mocked and avoided Evans for his prophetic visions and then his gruesome nose, which caused him to cover his face in public. But Evans found meaning in his facial difference that affirmed both his beloved king and his own sense of himself as a prophet with obligations to enlighten his leaders and community. And if the king's changing his nose was good evidence for that, then so be it. Whether the face is displayed or hidden by anything from a red cloth to a COVID mask, it is too open to interpretation to quickly tell us what jumpeth with the heart. Both Evans and his neighbours judged him by his appearance, but only Evans really knew the meaning of his face.